MTV's official challenge podcast is back for another season.
That's right. The challenge is about to embark on its monumental 40th season, y'all, and we are coming along for the ride.
Woohoo! That would be me, Devin Simone.
And then there's me, Davon Rogers.
And we're here to take you behind the scenes of the Challenge 40, Battle of the Eras.
Join us as we break down each episode, interview challengers, and take you behind the scenes of this iconic season.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Ceno Show. I'm your host, Ceno McFarlane. I'm an addiction specialist. I'm a coach, I'm a translator, and I'm God's middleman. My job is to crack hearts and let the light in and help everyone shift the narrative. I want to help you wake up, and I want to help you get free. Most importantly, I don't want you to feel alone. Listen to the Ceno Show every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. It's Katie Couric. Have you heard about my newsletter called Body and Soul? It has everything you need to know about health and wellness. From skincare and serums to meditation and brain health, we've got you covered. And most importantly, it's information you can trust. Everything is vetted by experts at the top of their field. Just sign up at katiecouric.com/bodyandsoul. That's KATIECOURIC.com/bodyandsoul. I promise you'll be happier and healthier if you do.
Okay, this is as serious as it gets. Another victim of the junk science of shaken baby syndrome, Robert Roberson, is scheduled for execution in the state of Texas on October 17th, 2024. I visited Robert at the Polunsky unit outside Houston just after Memorial Day 2022, and I remember walking away from him with a sick feeling in my stomach, knowing that the day might come when he would be put to death for a crime that never even happened. And here we are now on the precipice. Since our original coverage on July 7, 2022, coverage that gained Robert even more pro bono support from the powerful law firm Skadden Arps, even the lead detective in this case has come forward to acknowledge his mistake and asked Robert to forgive him. We'll link that video along with action steps in the episode description because it looks like it's going to take all of our help now if this innocent man is going to survive. Here's a new edit of our original coverage of Robert Roberson. On January 31st, 2002, 35-year-old Texan Robert Roberson said that his 2-year-old daughter Nikki had fallen out of bed in the middle of the night. And after comforting her, they both fell back to sleep. When he awoke again, Nikki wasn't breathing. Emergency room resuscitation efforts ultimately failed, and little Nikki was pronounced dead. Along with a bump on her head, an examination revealed brain swelling, as well as intracranial and retinal bleeding, the findings commonly associated with the now-debunked shaken baby syndrome hypothesis. Despite a number of viable causes of death, instead, Robert was accused of violently shaking his daughter to death. So the state of Texas now intends to put Robert to death as well. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm Jason Flom, and today's case, unfortunately, is going to sound like familiar territory. It's a shaken baby prosecution, which was based on a hypothesis that is now rejected by not only the original scientists, but also the scientific and medical communities that once held it to be a decided matter. Now, unfortunately, some of those attacked with that ill-fated diagnosis in a court of law are still languishing in prison. Too many. I mean, countless people, including our guest today, who is on death row in Texas, Robert Roberson. Now, my producer, Connor Hall, and I, we trekked down to the Polunsky unit in Livingston, Texas to record an interview with Robert. You'll hear pieces of that interspersed throughout our coverage today. Joining us now is his appellate attorney, Gretchen Swen. Gretchen, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Now, before we get into Robert's case, I want to refer everyone to our coverage of shaken baby syndrome on Wrongful Conviction Junk Science, which will be linked in the episode description. For decades, when a medical examiner was presented with brain swelling, bleeding inside the skull, and bleeding behind the eyes of an infant or a toddler, all other causes were not first ruled out, but totally ignored. And a leap in logic was made to two conclusions. First, that this triad of findings was caused by violent shaking, and later, abusive head trauma was included. And second, that the most recent caregiver must be the one responsible. Since the late 90s, over 80 medical conditions, and still counting, have been found to cause that exact triad of findings. Additionally, biomechanical studies have revealed that violent shaking simply cannot cause the triad without also first causing a spinal injury. Further, it's been proven that up to 72 hours can pass by before a child succumbs to these conditions, whether the cause was traumatic or simply a medical issue. The conclusion is that we cannot determine if a child was abused or violently shaken without first ruling out all the other causes. And after doing so, we cannot reliably place blame on the last person with them. And unfortunately, Robert Roberson was that final caretaker, and he was particularly vulnerable to prosecution.
This is somebody who grew up dirt poor in East Texas. He was in special ed classes. He was the one who was bullied. There was a lot of violence in the home, but, you know, had a mother who loved him dearly. But, you know, he drops out in ninth grade. You know, he was on the radar in terms of this is a struggling kid, and stumbles into what happens with so many poor, traumatized kids. He struggles with drug addiction. But this is a gentle soul. And, you know, you spend 5 minutes with Robert, and you see his speech is unusual. And he has this sort of flat affect, and he struggles to speak.
Okay. So you got some questions or something to ask? Okay.
Mm-hmm, sure. Okay. So, yeah, let me just introduce, first of all, this is Wrongful Conviction from death row in Texas. We're here on the Polunsky unit, where we've been before to visit Rob Will and Rodney Reed. Today we're here with another innocent man, a man named Robert Roberson. The man himself is like a big teddy bear. He's sitting right across from me through this window of bulletproof glass. Robert, thank you for being here and to talk to us today.
Thank you for being here.
And Robert, going back to the beginning, did you grow up in Texas?
I was born in Mineola, Texas and stuff. And we lived in Winsboro until I was 6 years old, you know. And then my dad worked for the railroad, and his job transferred to Palestine, Anderson County, you know.
You had a very difficult childhood, is that fair to say?
Oh, my dad was real rough, and my mom was there. My mom was like the glue to the family and stuff, you know, like the protector and stuff, but dad was like the provider.
Mm-hmm. And then you ended up going into the military, is that correct?
I went into the military when I was 17, Army, and they gave me a medical discharge later on because they said I couldn't adapt or something, like a training discharge, you know.
It has since been determined that Robert is on the autism spectrum, but at that time, he was just 20 years old with two children who had special needs. Robert and the kid's mother depended on the grandparents for help. Eventually, Robert had a third child, Nikki Bowman, whose custody was also shared, but there was a more contentious relationship with her grandparents. In addition, Nikki was born with a host of medical issues that it appears were never properly diagnosed or treated.
Nikki had been sick from essentially birth. This is a child on Medicaid. You know, she's being brought in. They're like, this antibiotic doesn't seem to work. Let's give her another one, you know, over and over again. And so there is a real tragedy in this child's short life of just the medical failures to get at what's going on with her. But I think that's sort of where the story begins. And then, you know, if you get to the point of trial, they acted like this history did not exist or certainly didn't matter, that you have a kid infected from 8 days old, pretty much onward. But the week before her collapse, she had been brought to the ER with initially 103.5 fever, I believe. She was throwing up. She had chronic diarrhea and trouble breathing. At this point, she is prescribed this medication, Phenergan, which contains promethazine, which now has a black box warning from the FDA that you don't give this to kids under the age of 10, and certainly don't give it to kids with respiratory issues because it might cause death. A few days later, she, at the doctor, the day after the emergency visit, had a fever over 104. They also give her another prescription for Phenergan, along with codeine cough syrup, which metastasizes into morphine. You know, they're treating it as if it's some, you know, annoying cold, but you're suppressing the respiratory system of a kid already in distress. So a day later, Robert is called by the grandparents who have been feuding with his mom for a year to come get this child who is sick and take her home back to his place. To me, this is another part of the mystery. If you have a sick two-year-old, I wonder what parent wants somebody to come out to the country, pick up the child at 9 o'clock at night, and knowing he's alone, because his girlfriend's getting a hysterectomy in the hospital. But oh no, Robert needs to come out and fetch this child, take her home.
This was January 30th into the 31st of 2002. And on this particular night, Robert was prepared to care for his then fiance in the wake of her hysterectomy.
His fiance is coming home from the hospital. He's trying to elevate the bed. The bed was really box springs and a mattress propped up on cinder blocks. But you look at these pictures and this bed is precarious. You know, that's where Nikki was sleeping. So it's completely legit that a disoriented sick child full of all these drugs tries to get up in the night and falls off the bed. And that would very easily explain this bump on the back of her head. It's in the night where he wakes up to this strange cry. And his report consistently was he found her on the floor at the foot of the bed. Didn't know what happened, but he saw a little bit of blood on her mouth. He got a washcloth, wiped it off, kept her sitting up for a while because she'd fallen out. So he thought maybe she hit her head, and he'd been told if somebody hits their head, you have to keep them awake. And then they fall back asleep. His alarm goes off a few hours later. He wakes up, finds Nikki blue, not breathing, faint heartbeat. He panics, shakes her a little to try to rouse her. Meanwhile, his girlfriend's calling him from the hospital to come get her. And he reports, well, Nikki's not breathing. He gets in the car, drives the short distance to the hospital, but the child never really recovers from this. And we have no idea how long had she ceased breathing. He gets up there into the ER. They see this, you know, guy standing there with a limp child.
And let's not forget how Robert presents to the world. He's a large man, well over 6 feet, 200 pounds, and socially awkward.
Immediately, the judgments start. They assume he did something to this child, whisk her away, code blue. But by that point, her eyes were already fixed and dilated, which means she'd probably already experienced brain death. It doesn't take long. It's about 12 minutes without oxygen. The brain shuts down. Once your brain dies, you're not coming back to life. But you revive the heart, you're pumping all this blood into the system, increasing the blood inside her head that can no longer get into the brain. They get her heart going, and it's about this same time they do a scan of her head. And they notice the goose egg, you know, swollen tissue on the back of her head. But the CAT scan showed that there was subdural bleeding and that the brain had swollen, and that then later on they realized there are also retinal hemorrhages. And this is the classic triad associated with shaking. So this bump on the head, one doctor that sees her later that day says, oh, that was minor. That could have happened at another time. But all this internal stuff, oh, that must have been caused by violent shaking and then flinging the child down against something. This became the theory instantly.
Soon, Nikki was pronounced dead, and it appears there are several avenues that could have led to both her demise as well as the triad of findings. Number one, there are now FDA warnings that Phenergan can cause respiratory failure in children under age 10. Codeine can also lead to suppressed respiration. In this case, there are two subsequent possibilities. A, oxygen deprivation is one of the over 80 medical conditions that can cause the triad of findings. And B, the post-brain death resuscitation effort pumped blood into her cranial cavity, yet was viewed as a symptom with which she had arrived at the hospital. The second avenue, short falls, like the one Robert said Nikki had taken from the elevated bed, has been enough in previous cases to cause the same triad and therefore her death, not to mention that any accidental trauma of this type could have occurred up to 72 hours before her untimely demise.
We now know that a short, unbraced fall where you hit your head, especially in a young child, there could be hours and even days before symptoms arise. You can have a traumatic brain injury, and yet the manifestations aren't visible.
It's terrifying, but true. Now, thirdly, years later, a re-examination of Nikki's medical records and autopsy have revealed that she was suffering from viral pneumonia, another one of the nonviolent medical causes for the triad of findings, and therefore her death. Yet, somehow, all of these possibilities were not ruled out, but ignored.
You have to realize this is a small rural community. The same ER doctor is on duty, who is the one who was giving her the Phenergan.
Oh boy.
And the pediatrician that had had her come to the office and measured her fever at 104.5 came to the hospital, and he's weighing in. And these are the people interviewing Robert, which in my mind, these are interested witnesses. And they, along with this collection of nurses, are making judgments about this man. And a lot of the testimony at his trial, which I know we'll get to, but right away there are these judgments. He wasn't crying at the right times. He wasn't showing enough concern. He was just standing there.
When I brought her into the hospital, I was freaking out and stuff, because they was trying to accuse me of being responsible for what happened to her and stuff, you know. And they said, oh, because he's acting a certain way, He must be guilty, you know. When you've been accused of something, you could be nervous or something, you know. For that to happen to your child, a child and stuff like that there, I don't think nobody's going to be in the right mind, you know, stuff, you know. Losing her is bad enough, but being accused of it, that's even worse, you know.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Katie Couric. If you follow me on social media, you know I love to cook, or at least try, especially alongside some of my favorite chefs and foodies like Benny Blanco, Jake Cohen, Lighty Hoik, Allison Roman, and of course, Ina Garten and Martha Stewart. So I started a free newsletter called Good Taste that comes out every Thursday, and it's serving up recipes that will make your mouth water. Think a candied bacon Bloody Mary, tacos with cabbage slaw, curry cauliflower with almonds and mint, and cherry slab pie with vanilla ice cream to top it all off. I mean, yum, I'm getting hungry. But if you're not sold yet, we also have kitchen tips like a foolproof way to grill the perfect burger, and must-have products like the best cast iron skillet to feel like a chef in your own kitchen. All you need to do is sign up at katiecouric.com/goodtaste. That's KATIECOURIC.com/goodtaste. I promise your taste buds will be happy you did.
Senora Sex Ed is not your mommy's sex talk.
This show is La Plática like you've never heard it before. We're breaking the stigma and silence around sex and sexuality in Latinx communities.
This podcast is an intergenerational conversation between Latinas from Gen X to Gen Z. We're covering everything from body image to representation in film and television. We even interview iconic Latinas like Puerto Rican actress Ana Ortiz.
I felt in control of my own physical body and my own self. I was on birth control. I had sort of had my first sexual experience.
If you're in your señora era or know someone who is, then this is the show for you.
We're your hosts, Diosa and Mala, and you might recognize us from our flagship podcast, Locatora Radio.
We're so excited for you to hear our brand new podcast, Señora Sex Ed.
Listen to Señora Sex Ed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In a galaxy far, far away.
No, babe, that's Taken. We're in our own world, remember?
Right. In our own world, we're two space cadets.
And totally normal humans.
Sure, totally normal humans.
Embark on a journey across the stars, discovering the wonders of the universe one episode at a time.
We'll talk about life, love, laughter, and why you should never argue with your co-pilot.
Especially when she's always right.
Right. And if we hit turbulence, just blame it on Mercury retrograde.
Or Emily's questionable space piloting skills.
Hey, join us on In Our Own World for cosmic conversations, stellar laughs,
and super corny dad jokes.
Listen to In Our Own World as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't worry, we promise to avoid any black holes.
Most of the time.
She had a fall that could very well have started the subdural bleeding, but she didn't even have skull fractures. What Nikki had was, this is critical, only one impact site on her exterior to this day. The medical examiner insists that she saw evidence of multiple impact sites to Nikki's head because of all the blood underneath.
Interestingly, the CAT scans that could have debunked this assertion went missing for almost 20 years. So even though there was only one bump on Nikki's head, this medical examiner, Dr. Jill Urban, claimed that the subdural bleeding was the result of multiple blunt force head injuries, ruling the death a homicide before any other testing, including a toxicology report that disclosed a lethal amount of phenergan. So the same people who had missed the viral pneumonia and unknowingly prescribed a deadly drug to the same toddler were the exact people looking at Robert sideways. But it gets even worse. A nurse, who, by the way, was not certified to perform sexual assault exams, volunteered to examine the child and proceeded to tell hospital staff and law enforcement that she saw anal tearing.
Jason, I do think this is the tail wagging the dog here. You have a week's worth of diarrhea, you're going to have in a two-year-old child some redness on their bottom. But she starts telling people, including the lead investigator in the hospital, what she sees. I think then you have mind blindness set in. All of the officers in are looking at Robert through the lens of, here is a man who potentially anally raped his two-year-old daughter. Then that takes over. They do a sexual assault test on swabs taken from this child. Nothing. They test everything they can find in the bedroom. Nothing. Nothing to confirm this sexual assault hypothesis. Now, they share this finding, quote unquote, with the medical team at Dallas Children's. Well, the child abuse expert, Dr. Squires, who apparently, you know, is looking all the time for sexual abuse, says she does not see what this nurse saw. All she saw is what she said at trial was what every mother has probably seen, which, you know, looks akin to diaper rash.
Yet that was not the last time this accusation was raised. In the meantime, this rural hospital also looked to Dallas Children's Hospital to confirm their finding of homicide.
When Nikki is taken to Dallas Children's, they look at the CAT scans and say, this is essentially classic shaken baby because of the triad. The child abuse expert, Dr. Squires, says, I was told that this was a healthy child. She was, quote, totally well right before her collapse. So the only explanation is that she was violently shaken. Now, first, as you know, we were discussing earlier, it's a total lie to suggest this was a totally well child. This was a chronically ill child with infections that had resisted, I think, 5 different kinds of antibiotics. She has a viral infection. Nobody is getting it.
So Dr. Squires supported the homicide ruling without knowing Nikki's medical history. In addition, the medical community at that time was unaware of the potential for a lucid interval of up to 72 hours from the time of a traumatic event or of the health condition-induced onset of the triad. And even though Robert had just received Nikki from her grandparents, that left only him as a possible shaking suspect. In addition, the medical community at this time was also unaware that in order for shaking to cause this triad, there had to have first been a neck injury. And that was not present in Nikki's case. She had no neck injury. But unfortunately, tragically, this discovery was a few years too late to help Robert when it was made by biomechanical engineers.
That's the community that started to point out to the medical community that this hypothesis was unfounded. It's like, we're studying injuries to children. We're the ones that are coming up with things like car seats for children and helmets. And, you know, shaking does not cause this kind of injury in any experiment that's ever been documented. So there are two fallacies at the very heart of the SBS phenomenon. One is that shaking could cause bridging veins in your dura to rupture. No. And that shaking would not cause neck injuries. Also, no. And Nikki had absolutely nothing wrong with her neck, but it was already orthodoxy by this point. It was being taught in medical schools. And that's why I think it just has such staying power as a legal phenomenon when it has no scientific support, because so many people's lives have been ruined. So they keep tweaking how you're supposed to go about making the diagnosis. But in the day when Robert was quickly written off as guilty, there was no internal doubt within the medical community. So he's arrested that day on that information.
And then the prosecutor once again raised the sexual assault allegations, even though their own medical experts would not support it.
And yet they dare to indict him on this. And every single potential juror is asked about the sexual abuse component that's going to be a part of this trial, along with shaken baby. Every single juror is told that's the theory the state has, that there was sexual assault, and that's the motivation for him to violently shake her to cover this up.
So he was represented, if we can call it that, by Steve Evans and John Van Meter. Talk to us about their efforts or lack thereof.
They stated on the record in opening statements that this was, unfortunately, a shaken baby case, no doubt about it. At that time, there were very few experts even available to come in and challenge the state's causation theory. This was 2002. Everybody believed shaken baby was an article of faith. It had been accepted by the American Pediatric Association. Some of the people that came to our aid only recently, some very famous, renowned experts in 2001, 2002, 2003, were just starting to sound the alarm.
So the knowledge wasn't even really readily available to his own attorneys for them to even believe in his innocence.
And they saw their job as just to try to prevent entry of a death sentence.
My attorney at trial had two of them. They had tried to do a plea bargain stuff, and I told them I didn't do nothing. My mama said I didn't do nothing. Don't take nothing, right? And thing is, my mom's family lawyer had gave her a pamphlet to go to Trinity Valley Community College in Athens for a seminar on shaken baby cases. Who did she see there? Doug Lowe, the head DA. He didn't know what was going on either.
It appears that the prosecution and the defense team were totally out of their depth. The state side taking seminars likely given by someone who was a true believer in this now proven junk science. And while the defense was essentially agreeing to some degree of murder without intent, the state was trying to take it a step further.
Your trial was a farce. I mean, they pulled dirty tricks, accusing you of sexually abusing the child they knew that that was not the case. And they knew that she had had this horrible diarrhea that would have provided an exact explanation for why these symptoms were present. They decided to sort of taint the jury by bringing that ridiculous theory, which was later dropped.
And they did taint the jury because you hear a story about a child and stuff, it makes a lot of people mad, right?
Of course.
And it made that jury mad. It tainted that jury.
They painted you into a monster, and I'm sitting here staring you right in the eyes.
Yes,
I mean, this man is no monster. I can tell you right off the bat. And
I'm kind of friendly, really, you know. people said, you're fine. I said, no, I'm not a father no more. I'm a lover, you know, friendly, you know.
And again, I won't say that this was a conscious plot, but I do think they had expected Robert would take a plea deal. He adamantly would not. And I would say in almost any death penalty case, what the state recognizes implicitly is that they must turn the defendant into a monster, because normal human beings don't want to come in and sign off on killing a fellow member of the human species. They sounded this horrifically prejudicial sexual theme and then dropped it right when it went to the jury, because they really had no evidence except for this one nurse, who, by the way, was on the stand pretty much longer than anyone else. Robert's attorneys did resist the sexual assault allegations, but only through cross-examination. Meanwhile, the state's bringing in experts who are telling the jury this kid was violently shaken. And so if you're told that, and then you also have a nurse saying, and by the way, I also think there was sexual abuse, someone that would violently shake a child, well, they might have also abused a child. These things become possible. There was no counter narrative. And he was not convicted of that, but they maintain that, well, there was no evidence he didn't do it. I am not kidding you. There was closing argument about how even if they weren't going to decide the issue, they should consider it.
And the judge allows that.
Judge allowed it.
So the jury comes back in. At the time, did you still have some hope that they would see the truth and that they would end this nightmare?
I was hoping they would, so, because attorney kept telling me, we can win this case. We can win this case. This case is a winnable case. When they came back talking about guilty and stuff, you know, I don't know what I really thought at the time. And my mom wasn't there and stuff. But before the punishment, my mom had to go check on my dad. He was in the old folks home, you know. And when she got back, they done gave me the death sentence and stuff, you know. Couldn't believe they convicted me of something that I didn't do, you know.
Hello everyone, I am Lacey Lamar.
And I'm Amber Ruffin, a better Lacey Lamar.
Boo.
Okay, everybody, we have exciting news to share. We're back with season 2 of the Amber and Lacey, Lacey and Amber show on Will Ferrell's Big Money Players Network. You thought you had fun last season? Well, you were right. And you should tune in today for new fun segments like Sister Court and listening to Lacey's steamy DMs.
We've got new and exciting guests like Michael Beach, that's my husband, Daphne Spring, Daniel Thrasher, Peppermint, Morgan J, and more. You gotta watch us.
No, you mean you have to listen to us. I mean, you can still watch us, but you gotta listen. Like, if you're watching us, you have to tell us. Like, if you're out the window, you have to say, hey, I'm watching you outside of the window. Just, you know what? Listen to the Amber and Lacey, Lacey and Amber show on Will Ferrell's Big Money Players Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Sino Show. I'm your host, Sino McFarland. I'm an addiction specialist. I'm a coach, I'm a translator, and I'm God's middleman. My job is to crack hearts and let the light in and help everyone shift the narrative. Whether your get down is sex, drugs, alcohol, love addiction, self-hate, codependency, or anything else for that matter, I want to help you wake up and I want to help you get free. I want to help you unleash your potential, overcome obstacles, and achieve your goals. Most importantly, I don't want you to feel alone. So join me on The Sino Show, where each week we'll feature a compelling individual with an even more noteworthy story that will be sure to inspire and educate. Listen to The Sino Show every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, it's me, Katie Couric. If you follow me on social media, you know I love to cook, or at least try, especially alongside some of my favorite chefs and foodies like Benny Blanco, Jake Cohen, Lighty Hoik, Allison Roman. and of course, Ina Garten and Martha Stewart. So I started a free newsletter called Good Taste that comes out every Thursday, and it's serving up recipes that will make your mouth water. Think a candied bacon Bloody Mary, tacos with cabbage slaw, curry cauliflower with almonds and mint, and cherry slab pie with vanilla ice cream to top it all off. I mean, yum, I'm getting hungry. But if you're not sold yet, we also have kitchen tips like a foolproof way to grill the perfect burger and must-have products like the best cast iron skillet to feel like a chef in your own kitchen. All you need to do is sign up at katiecourick.com/goodtaste. That's KATIECOURIC.com/goodtaste. I promise your taste buds will be happy you did.
I've locked up January 31st, 2002. So a little bit over 20 years I've been locked up. I don't wish this on my worst enemy and stuff, you know, because but being in a place like this, like a nightmare and stuff, you know, especially when you hadn't done nothing to be here in the first place, you know. And then, you know, I lost my mom last September, and I lost my dad since I've been in here and stuff. I lost the chance of seeing my son and my daughter grow up, being away from family all this time, lost all those years and stuff. It was stole from me, you know. So it destroyed my life, you know.
It's absolutely heartbreaking, and the authorities appear to have been doing what they, I guess, thought was the right thing at the time, but our understanding of these instances has now advanced considerably. It's almost like a 180. But before our more enlightened understanding of SBS, Robert faced denials in his direct appeal and state habeas.
Robert was on the verge of execution in 2016. That's when I was at a state public defender's office and we agreed to take on the case. And based on the change in science around the controversy of Shaken Baby, we got a stay of his execution and the right to get back into state court to try to prove our claims. That then took many years.
During this time, Gretchen was trying to uncover the CAT scans from January 31st, 2002, and both medical centers had maintained that they had been lost or destroyed, as did the state. And then during the opening statements of this evidentiary hearing, something really crazy happened.
In the middle of my opening statement, this clerk with goodwill listened and thought, well, I wonder if this stuff she's referring to could be buried in the courthouse basement. It, you know, had nothing to do with the motions I'd filed seeking Brady evidence. That hadn't led to someone discovering this. It was this one woman. Why the scans were buried in the courthouse basement, I do not know. But then we had a long hiatus so we could have a chance to have an expert look at that. And it confirms that there was only one impact site on Nikki's head. And that was that small swollen tissue on the back right of Nikki's head. That is exculpatory. The medical examiner who did not look at the head scans at the time, and now, decades later, to this day, she insists that she saw evidence of multiple impact sites to Nikki's head because of all the blood underneath. Nonsensical. It doesn't work that way. You cannot impact a child's head sufficiently enough to cause internal damage and leave no mark on the outside. And what Nikki had was minimal bruising on her exterior. The blood underneath cannot be read like tea leaves. And yet that is what this medical examiner has done. Whereas the scans, which are the reliable evidence about whether or not there were impact sites, shows that one site, one and only site.
Even though this didn't run counter to Dr. Squire's ruling that this was an SBS case, which of course, and I can't emphasize this enough, SBS is not a real thing. It's been debunked. However, the missing CT scan supported Robert's version of events while directly contradicting Dr. Urban, who was the one who had initially ruled Nikki's death a homicide. And that was enough to win an evidentiary hearing. And after being delayed by COVID, it resumed in March 2021.
Here we are. 20 years later, having amassed an overwhelming amount of evidence from experts who have identified the toxic level of prescription drugs in this child's system, the interstitial viral pneumonia, the lack of evidence of impact sites, and all the change in the understanding of shaken baby syndrome. All of that was put before trial court and deemed not new evidence.
It's absolutely freaking bonkers. The biomechanical strides alone prove that if shaking was the cause of the triad of findings, there would first need to be a spinal or a neck injury. And Nikki had none. The state's theory just didn't hold water. It made room for every viable avenue that we'd laid out at the beginning. The lethal dose of Phenergan causing respiratory arrest with oxygen deprivation or the resuscitation effort causing the triad, or her undiagnosed viral pneumonia. Even the shortfall alone could have done it while being the source of the single swollen impact site. Meanwhile, Dr. Urban admitted to never having looked at the CT scans when she said that there were multiple impacts and ruled the death a homicide.
This medical examiner admitted that she didn't even look at the CAT scans. She didn't listen to the testimony of all these new experts. She didn't seem to understand the interstitial viral pneumonia in the lung tissues that she'd collected, and instead just seemed to stand by this idea that the blood in the subdural space was enough for her to say, oh, well, whether it was shaking or not, it was still abuse. This was something I asked the medical examiner in court. You know, I said, let's say I walk outside the courtroom. There are these marble steps and no one else is around and I slip and I hit the back of my head and I become unconscious. And later you take a look at me. What is it that your background, your training has taught you that you could look at me and determine whether or not I'd fallen or someone had pushed me or someone had come up and hit me in the back of the head with a blunt object? Explain that to me.
Or shook you.
Yeah. And of course she couldn't. And what is appalling about this is that the shaking hypothesis that she furthered at trial, along with the child abuse expert, she was telling the jury all about shaking, that that's why you look at the outside of this child, you don't see much, but the reason you know it's abuse is because shaking explains how all this stuff happens. Well, A, we now know shaking doesn't, but she couldn't tell me how blunt force trauma, even if it's not shaking, could be looked at after the fact and you could say whether it was inflicted or not, because there's no science that would allow you to do that. That would require, you know, voodoo.
With Dr. Urban having undermined her own credibility, left Squires, for which Gretchen presented the updated scientific consensus on the matter, along with instances in which Dr. Squires recanted testimony in other Texas SBS cases. The Center for Integrity and Forensic Sciences also submitted an amicus brief supporting Robert, but ultimately the motion was denied, with the court citing that no new evidence had been submitted. I mean, make it make sense.
Robert's case has been submitted as per Texas procedure to the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the highest court for criminal matters in the state of Texas. So they will, one hopes, look at the huge volume of new evidence and look at it anew and really evaluate the allegations about the change in the scientific perspective from the time of his trial, which is the fundamental basis for our claims for relief. We also have an actual innocence claim, which is much stronger now than when we filed the claim because of the evidence of pneumonia, of the CAT scans that were finally produced, et cetera. But ultimately, you cannot read that trial transcript and compare that to contemporary understanding, even among people that believe shaken baby syndrome has some validity. You cannot read the trial transcript and fail to recognize it's full of falsehoods. And we hope the Court of Criminal Appeals will dig into that and then grant him a new trial. And then it's like, go back to the trial court again and see if they really want to try again to convict him based on this horrifically scanty evidentiary record.
Well, if they give you a chance and try to go ahead with what they presented in 2002, I think they'd realize pretty quickly that we just didn't know better back then and they'd let this go.
Yeah.
Everyone that's listening now, what can they do?
A wonderful supporter of Robert has created a website. There are court filings there. And certainly the latest filing that amasses all the new evidence and explains why a new trial is worthwhile.
Well, we'll have that linked in the bio, as well as ways our audience can reach out to Robert. And with that, we move to closing arguments, where I thank you both for sharing your story. And then I'm going to turn my microphone off, leave my headphones on, and just listen.
for anything else that you feel is left to be said. Let's start off with you, Gretchen, and have Robert take us off into the sunset.
I mean, I would like for the audience to picture themselves as a parent or any parent they know and put yourself in the shoes of Robert. But imagine yourself without resources, an impairment that makes communication fundamentally difficult. And from the moment you arrive at the hospital with your comatose child, you're being interrogated, accused, and the accusations get worse and worse by the minute. So that by the end of a single day, you've gone from your child who's relatively new to your life is gone, and they won't even allow you to say farewell because you're being taken to jail. And before there's even an indictment, there's a statement from a hospital saying, it's got to be shaken baby syndrome. Yet no one assesses the medical records and try to put all these pieces together. And it is a complicated puzzle, but every single piece points away from a crime and towards a tragic story of a young child who was sick from the moment she was born into unfortunate circumstances and then not given the fair shake that she deserved. It's not just about Robert. Nikki deserves a history that is based on the truth. And I urge people to just pay attention to what's being done in their names with our criminal justice systems. I came from a civil background, and everything I learn every day adds to my shock and outrage.
Okay. What I want to encourage both of y'all to continue to do what y'all doing and stuff, because I believe in y'all and everybody else that's doing fighting against this corrupt legal system and stuff, wrongful convictions. You know, keep on doing what you're doing, you know. I'm going to continue to fight because, you know, God knows and I know, you know, that was done wrong and stuff. And I'm very grateful for what y'all doing, very grateful for everybody that's involved in it. And may y'all have a safe trip back home and stuff. May the Lord bless y'all and shine up his face upon y'all. And I'd just like to encourage both y'all to continue to do what you're doing.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
MTV's official challenge podcast is back for another season.
That's right. The challenge is about to embark on its monumental 40th season, y'all, and we are coming along for the ride.
Woohoo! That would be me, Devin Simone.
And then there's me, Davon Rogers.
And we're here to take you behind the scenes of The Challenge 40, Battle of the Eras.
Join us as we break down each episode, interview challengers, and take you behind the scenes of this iconic season.
Listen to MTV's official challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. It's Katie Couric. Have you heard about my newsletter called Body and Soul? It has everything you need to know about health and wellness, from skincare and serums to meditation and brain health. We've got you covered. And most importantly, it's information you can trust. Everything is vetted by experts at the top of their field. Just sign up at katiecouric.com/bodyandsoul. That's katiecouric.com/bodyandsoul. I promise you'll be happier and healthier if you do.